Rich Egger, and this is Emphasis. Today's guest is Geography Professor Emeritus Bill Griffin of Western Illinois University. He's author of the new book, Voices of the Hennepin Canal. Why are you interested in the Hennepin Canal?
For starters, I was raised in Sheffield, Illinois, which is about 4.5 miles south of the canal main line. I knew it through my father. He used to take me. He had a gas truck to supply farmers. And then later he taught me how to fish as well as I could. And then I had friends in high school whose fathers worked on the canal. I had quite a bit of swimming, you know, particularly at one site. So I knew the people.
And when was the canal created and why?
The purpose goes back to the early 1870s, and it was conceived, and this was at the time when the railroads were really dominant, starting with, you know, on interstate commerce. And one of the problems was states could regulate local rail rates, but there was nothing to regulate interstate rates. The Interstate Commerce Act had not been passed as yet. So the concept was put forth that the best way to regulate interstate rail rates was through water transport. And so there was a move for a connection, an all-water connection between the Mississippi River, Great Lakes, Erie Canal, Hudson River to New York. And in fact, there was a project in Wisconsin using the Fox Rivers and the Wisconsin Rivers that up until the late 1880s was a viable contender for that Mississippi Great Lakes route. And it turned out that they couldn't, it would be too expensive to develop the Wisconsin River. So it, by default, if you will, it came to the Hennepin Canal. That was one thing. The other thing that I was intrigued with was this was the first time in the United States where Portland cement concrete was used to build navigation locks, dams, abutments, and so on. And through a lot of rigorous testing over years, even throughout the 18 years it took to build the canal from 1892 to 1908, and they were still building lock tenders houses after that. But it's a methodology that still is used today, but in more modern form. This led to the same techniques applied to the Panama Canal, same techniques applied today to the Mississippi River, Illinois River, Ohio River, and so on. It's the same process of it had to be a continuous pour over a 24-hour period, or the length of time it took to pour a particular section.
And that's, I guess, what makes this project really stand out is it's the first time this technique was used, and it's proven to be such a good technique that it's still used today.
Yeah, it's still used rather than labor force now, where you have hydraulic jacks that actually ram the concrete rather than a person there with a rammer, almost like a toilet stool flusher, you know, a toilet bowl. Also, there was the feeder extended from the canal extended from the Illinois River to the above Hennepin to the Mississippi River west of Milan. It's called the Hennepin Canal. That was its unofficial title. Officially, it was the Illinois and Mississippi Canal.
It's no longer used for interstate commerce. It's been a long time since it's been used for that. Why did they cease using it?
Part of it had to do with, and I think a large part of it, I did not offer any conclusions in the book. It's, in a way, it's kind of speculation, but the time it took between when the first canal bill was put in, it was in the House in 1874, and when final authorization was was granted in 1890, there were 17 canal bills, and not one was debated on the floor of the House or the floor of the Senate, depending on who was in control. It was mainly the Democrats, which were opposed to it. They said there was nothing wrong with canals for states, but it had to be built by the states. The thing that is, I think, instructive is we follow the same process today. We have, for example, something I was interested in because it involved the Mississippi and Illinois, was the Water Resources Act of 2007, which for the first time passed a Congress authorizing beginning construction of a new system of 1,200-foot locks on the Illinois and Mississippi, but it didn't appropriate any money, and it still has not appropriated any money. So in order for this to become a reality, they're going to have to go back and do it all over again. And so any bottleneck is really in how the Congress does business. We tend to do these things on a piecemeal basis. And that's what happened with on the Mississippi and on the Illinois, and in the case of the Hennepin. By the time it was completed, it was virtually obsolete in terms of size.
Mm-hmm. This is a state park now. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah, Hennepin Canal Parkway State Park.
Now the entire stretch is considered a state park.
The stretch from Bureau at Lock 2, actually you can Lock 1, but Lock 1 is underwater now, up through Lock 29 at west of Kelowna, and then there's a 4.5 mile Milan section. That's part of the state park, as is a 29.5 mile feeder that supplied water to the canal main line from the Rock River. That is all part of the state park. Here again, it's unfortunate that the labor force associated with the state park and every other state park in Illinois has been decimated. And it started under Governor Blagojevich. DNR, Department of Natural Resources, is just, they don't have enough people to do their jobs. And where earlier the banks were kept mowed and so on and so forth, now they're growing up and it's essentially preventive maintenance. You look where the worst problems are. You chase the worst problems. But interestingly enough, the locks, the abutments, the dams, the aqueducts are still in fine shape after 100 and some years.
So this was well built.
It was well built, except in one place, all without rebars, no steel, just concrete.
You mentioned the Milan stretch in your last answer. You're going to be leading a field tour of that stretch of the canal. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is going to be, I think, our fifth annual, be fourth annual, but fifth Upper Mississippi River Conference that Western, in conjunction with River Action, the Corps of Engineers, Rock Island District, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, and some other organizations have put together, that's held every year in September in Moline, Rock Island, Davenport. We move it around. This year it's going to be at Stony Creek Inn at Moline, but the opening reception is going to be at our new building on the riverfront campus. Joe Reeves is going to be our host that night. But I'm taking, I think they envision two kind of mini vans of people, probably 20 some people on a field trip on the three locks and some of the other works, the bridge work and stuff like that on the 4.5 mile Milan section.
You mentioned you grew up not far from the canal, but in the course of researching this book, what did you learn about the canal?
I continued to be impressed by the amount of this was, first of all, this was, I don't know, however you compare it, however you cut it up, this was a massive undertaking in a 75-mile stretch in a 29.5-mile feeder to build that much, create that much. For example, the feeder was engineered so the water from the Rock River flowed by gravity 29.5 miles to the main line. It was engineered to drop an average of 1 inch a mile. They had emergency gates at places where if there was a break in the embankment and it went out, these would automatically close. The biggest culprit in many cases were muskrats, groundhogs, that would burrow in the canal banks. Lock tenders and patrolmen had exclusive trapping rights. This friend of mine, whose father was a lock tender, every winter, I knew him in high school, he had a trapping run. And it made him money. I think he was getting 50 cents a pelt or something like that. But most important from the canal's maintenance standpoint is he was keeping down the muskrat population. Also, ice was cut. At that time, they had ice boxes, no big Frigidaire.
No refrigeration like today.
No, so they stored them in peat bogs, stored them in sheds with peat, and then sold them out to nearby communities where if you've ever seen an old ice box, you put the chunk of ice in the top, and it was just convection. It was heavier, so it went down and circulated.
How long did it take you to research and write the book?
Oh, good grief. I became interested. We moved back to Illinois in 1968. And my father, who was getting up there in years at that time, although he did live to be 79, he had memories when he was a kid and also when he worked for Meckling Barge Company on the canal. And he introduced me to a person by the name of Clarence Sapp, who worked on the canal, started in 1929. And I interviewed him. And so it was basically a lot of pictures and interviews with my father, Clarence Sapp. That was back in 1980.
Those would be the voices of the Hennepin Canal.
Well, it started. Then. It started, and then over the years, I got more interested. Spent a lot of time in Springfield in the archives. Using Western's resources with engineer reports, congressional records, so on and so forth. And it was a lot of fun.
Bill Griffin is a geography professor emeritus at Western Illinois University. He's also author of the new book, Voices of the Hennepin Canal, Promoters, Politicians, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. We're out of time for today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rick.
For Tri-States Public Radio News, I'm Rich Egger.